Welcome to Clarity, Not Consensus, a podcast shining some light on how our theological convictions about men and women are lived out in our ministry relationships and in the decision-making forums at all levels of the Presbyterian Church in New South Wales, in assembly committees, presbyteries, and in the local church. Welcome to this episode of Clarity Not Consensus. My name is Sylvia Siu, and today I'm joined by Vera Butchveska. Vera is the director of the Conduct Protocol Unit, sometimes called the CPU, of Jericho Road, which is the Mercy Ministry arm of the Presbyterian Church of New South Wales. Vera helps us understand why trust and intentional consultation matters, particularly when the decisions being made affect vulnerable people, and how the structures within the Presbyterian Church can benefit from the contributions of women. I'm so encouraged by Vera's work alongside the Jericho Road team in this space. Their compassionate work and advocacy is a helpful reminder that hearing vulnerable people's voices is simply an expression of Christ's care for his people. Well, welcome to this episode of Clarity, Not Consensus. Today, I'm joined by Vera Butchveska. Did I say that right, Vera?
Good enough.
Welcome, Vera. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and also how I should have pronounced your name? That would be helpful.
So it's three syllables, Butchveska, okay. For those who like to get these things correct, but I will take most things. I'm not the best at talking about myself, but I can talk, happy to talk about issues that I feel strongly about, which are trauma, social justice, mental health, and also more recently, neurodiversity and carers. Those are just some things that I've had experience with personally. I've lived in Sydney my whole life, which I think is pretty boring, but I do have I can say I've got rural experience. So I was part of a inland mission with Scripture Union for 13 years. So every January for 13 years, I would go to Gunnedah, and you know we'd run a summer mission there in partnership with a number of churches, and that was great fun. So that's my country sort of bit. And I've got two girls, one in primary school, one in high school, and we attend St. Luke's Concord. I like eating out. I have no real hobbies because the kids are my hobbies, really. They take up most of the time, but sometimes there's a bit of a half-baked effort at gardening and trying to declutter.
Yeah. The same, half-baked effort at gardening and decluttering. It is a slow journey. It's living out the curse in this fallen world, isn't it? Can you tell us a little bit about how you came to know Jesus?
Yeah, so I grew up at the Chinese Christian Church in Milton's Point. Some people might know that. And I'll say I was guilted into going to a church camp by my friends. That's an encouragement for you who have teenagers, to encourage your friends to get their friends to go along to things like youth group and church camps. So even though I'd heard the gospel for many, many years, it wasn't until a particular camp, I was in year 10, it was Good Friday, and essentially Jesus opened my eyes to the sacrifice that he'd made on the cross for us, that, you know, and I sort of remember thinking, wow, who would give up their life for me? So it wasn't necessarily that night that I became a Christian, but it was kind of that really triggered the thought of, okay, you know, if I know that this is true, if I know that he died and rose for me, I can't just kind of go, oh, that's nice, and go back to my whatever it is I'm doing. Like, I really need to ask the question, is he going to be my Lord and Saviour? So that, yeah, kind of taking it seriously from about the age of 16.
Amazing. Mm. You've been working at CPU for Jericho Road. Can you tell us about what is CPU Who are Jericho Road and what are the roles that you've had there?
Yeah, so the Conduct Protocol Unit is it's been established by the General Assembly, which is, I guess, the powers that be within the Presbyterian Church for New South Wales. And Jericho Road was formerly called Presbyterian Social Services, but I guess the best way to describe it, it's like the Mercy Ministry of the Presbyterian Church. And so one of the things that there's a number of things that come under Jericho Road. So there's ELOWA, which is children's services to children who have severe disabilities. There's chaplaincy care, refugee ministry, and a whole lot of other kind of things. And what I love about Jericho Road is that it is small enough to, to be responsive to needs. So it's not this huge organisation where you have to jump through 10 hoops and fill in form after form to, to get something. We can be quite responsive to people's individual needs. And so this the CPU, we support the denomination in implementing its, I'll call, safe ministry policy. So it's a policy which is about preventing and responding to abuse. So I've been part of that team for 9 years now. Yeah, so before I joined the CPU, I trained as a social worker. That's my, I guess, work background. And I worked in the public mental health system for a long time. I'm kind of embarrassed to say how long, but that included psychiatric emergency through to adult and community, sorry, adult and aged care community mental health teams. And I also had some experience of working in the two adult burns units in Sydney. And I kind of say this half joking but half serious, it actually was a really good training ground to work with another institution being the Presbyterian Church. So it helps me to have an understanding of how to navigate different systems. And also through that, have had my fair share of exposure to trauma abuse. And so I say, I'm great for, talking at parties.
Yeah, one of the occupational hazards of being in these spaces, I think.
Yeah, I don't talk about it, essentially.
Yeah.
So I'm like, what do I say?
What are the main things you're currently doing at CPU at the moment?
Yeah, so the things that maybe if I can just talk a little bit about our team as well. So
Yeah,
it's not
sure.
just me. There's a whole team of us. So we've got an admin manager. We've got an audit manager. It's auditing around implementation of the breaking the silence policy. We've got a training and resource manager, a case manager, and a chaplain. We're all part-time. And we work off the smell of an oily rag. So I support them to do their job. And together, we work to provide the denomination with the best possible support, advice, and resources in relation to child safety, but also protecting vulnerable people, which I'll say is anyone really. We're all vulnerable. And so the role of the director is to oversee all these different functions. But in terms of what we're doing currently, we're working on a refresh of the Breaking the Silence Foundations training. So it's the training that people have to do if they're in a position of authority or working with children and young people. We've recently updated our website. We develop resources, so we'll put out a number of tip sheets during the year. We put out one on trauma-informed care earlier this year, and we'll be putting one out on pornography. And we run other kinds of training as well. So recently we've run a trauma-informed care webinar, and later in the year we'll be running training on understanding and responding to domestic violence, and they're specifically designed for church communities. And we speak to people when they contact us when they need advice about different abuse matters.
Yeah, that I'm just so overwhelmed by how much work is being done by CPU. And I know we listed a lot of people, but all of them being part-time, you're right, this is just running on the smell of an oily rag. This is really incredible output for the number of you that are there and the few days a week that you're there.
Yeah, we do our best, and there's, a never-ending list of things that we would like to do and love to do, and we just have to prioritize the things that we can do in the time and resources that we have. But I'm really thankful for all of them, and I think we work really well together.
So there's a lot that you do. What's the best part of your role?
Yeah, the best part of the role is being able to use my training and experience from, I guess, health background to support those not only who have experienced trauma or abuse themselves, but also those who are supporting those who are on the receiving end of receiving and disclosures. People on the ground in churches, listening to stories of victims and aggrieved people. And also, it's a real blessing to work in partnership with sessions and presbyteries. I mean, we're really kind of serving them, where, the team is there to support the church. And so it's a real encouragement to me when I'm talking with ministers or elders and they're raising these really complex and difficult issues in their churches. And we're really kind of wrestling and nutting out what's the best way to do that. And I really love that we can have those conversations together. And if it's helpful for them, then I'm encouraged by that. So I mean, we really want them to support, we want to support them to do their job better because, elders' sessions are a collection of a wide variety of people with different backgrounds and experiences. But my background is being experienced in understanding abuse and how to, support people who have been abused. So again, I was talking about the best thing is also getting to equip the church to show Jesus' love and care. And so, those webinars and the training that I mentioned, that's one of the things that I love to do as well.
That's fantastic. What's the hardest thing about your job?
Yeah, I think there's a few things. So just because we are part-time, the tyranny of not having enough time and, being limited in or needing to be realistic in what we can actually achieve. There is also that mental incongruence of people who are in positions of leadership and, have allegations made against them. So, when I worked in the public health system, you don't bat an eye because you expect to hear stories of, people being harmed and abused. And we know that because we know that we're living in a fallen world. We know that we're all infected with sin. But when you come into the church and, you yourselves are a Christian and the standard to which God calls you, he calls us to live lives that are honourable and good and upright, and ministers are held to an even higher standard. And so when you receive these stories about people who are in positions of authority, you think you actually ought to know better. But we also have to, I mean, yeah, I regularly remind myself that we're all sinners, we're all fallen. Yeah, so it's kind of just, sitting with that, balancing those things in my mind. That's a hard thing. I think another hard thing is, I guess, just that thought of sometimes you have doubts about, did I get that right? Did I miss something? And think particularly of instances where we might have received a notification and, we give the best information and advice that we can at the time, and then it comes back, sometime later, and the situation actually, it went pear-shaped. And I kind of, in those moments, I think to myself, did I miss something in this? I guess the other thing is where we are working in systems. Given that we're all sinners and we're working in systems, and we know that no system is perfect because we ourselves are not perfect. And so we're trying to support people to navigate systems which are imperfect. And that can be quite challenging. And we don't always get it right. And it takes humility to apologize and say we could do better on this. And so when you see the harm that is done in people's lives and the mistrust that's created, that is also a challenging thing. And particularly when there is, perhaps a growing mistrust between leadership and the people that they're shepherding for whatever reason. Sometimes there's good reasons, sometimes there's reasons that people just don't understand because, they don't have a right to know everything. But that they're really tricky things to navigate.
I think this is like that gardening and decluttering thing. This is just life in the fall. And we're the redeemed and we're not no longer under the curse, but that journey for the church to look more like Jesus is a slow and a hard one. And particularly in your role, you would tend to see more of the brokenness and the fallenness. And so thank you for doing the work that you do. The only way to be able to do that and remain in Christ is to have our eyes fixed on him, because otherwise I think it would just be too overwhelming.
I went through Bible college and funnily, although it makes total sense, what I got out of doing those 3 years is trust God. Know that he's good, know that he's faithful, and you just keep holding on to that.
Why do you do this work? What is so important to you, in this work?
Yeah, I think, oh, look, we're all, we live in the body of Christ and we all have different roles and we, accept the reality people have been hurt and abused and mistreated and God calls us to care for them. So I just pulled out Luke 4. That was one of the passages that I referred to in the trauma-informed care webinar. Where Jesus is pointing to himself as saying, he's come to proclaim good news to the poor, to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim freedom for the captives. God loves the brokenhearted. He saves those who are crushed in spirit. So I think, anyone, well, I mean, in theory, any of us could do this, but we're all called to, show God's love and compassion, and this is just one part where, or one role where I have the opportunity to do that. So that's a real privilege. And in terms of, well, what's important about it, I guess referring to the role of the CPU, one of those roles is to help people access the systems that are available to them to seek justice. And so, even though the CPU needs to be neutral, we can't take sides in when people contact us, but we can empower people by giving them information about what they can do if they want to speak up about abuse or seek help in an abuse situation. And I think the other thing is that this is not it. An exclusive issue to the Presbyterian, but people in churches simply don't know the structures and processes that exist. Even those that may have been part of a church for many years, you can go to church for your whole life, and if there's no issues, great. But as soon as there's an issue, you kind of think, well, who do I talk to? I'm not sure. What if the problem is with the minister, or what if the problem is with the leadership team? Where do you go? And some people just really don't know. So one of the things that we try to do is to help people navigate that structure, and point them to, the pathways where their complaint can be heard. And one of the benefits or advantages of the conduct protocol unit is we sit outside of the sessions and the presbyteries. And so in that sense, there is some independence, because one of the issues is if you're in a church, you're like, well, who can I talk to if I have an issue with the leadership team? Because the people who need to address the issue are the leadership team.
I think we'll talk about that more in a minute. I'm so encouraged by your response to this question. I think because in my work as the Women's Ministry Facilitator, I think people tend to assume that the reason I do my job is because I want to fight for women's rights, or the reason you do your job is because you want to hold people with power to account. But actually, the reason you want to do it is because you see the way that Jesus looks to the hurt, abused, mistreated. The reason I do this job is because I see Jesus loves women, and I see the way that Jesus saw women and lifted them up. And because I see the goodness of the Presbyterian system and the structures that exist, like, I love that scaffolding. I want to strengthen that scaffolding. I want more people to be aware of the scaffolding that's there, because I think they're good things that help us to live out our calling in God's kingdom better. So I'm encouraged by your answer, and I hope that people listening are also encouraged that this isn't about, it's not actually about a fight, despite what people may think and our polarized world may tell us. It's just about looking to reflect the goodness of Jesus in a broken world.
Yeah, I love it.
I've called back to my role as Women's Ministry Facilitator for the Women's Ministry Committee, but this podcast is actually a podcast of the Women's Engagement Working Group. The Women's Engagement Working Group was established a few years ago, and our vision statement is to see the Presbyterian Church in New South Wales develop and nurture a culture in its decision-making forums, where the contribution of men and women are sought and valued equally in a way that shapes our everyday practices, our conversations, our structure, our polity, and our code. That's a bit of a mouthful. We will have that in the show notes if you want to have a look and read over that again. But from what you see in your role, Vera, what aspects of the Prezi Church's decision-making forums work well?
Yeah, my own experience in how issues of abuse are dealt with, because they do end up being determined or decided either by session or presbytery, they work well when there's good communication and consultation, and when there's a real proactivity and intentionality in including both men and women in the processes. So an example of that might be female consultation. And because the Presbyterian system is kind of designed as a flat hierarchy, I do think there is value in everyone getting a say, and there is strength and collaboration in the wisdom of the elders. So not just elders in a Presbyterian sense, but in the sense that it is a collective, a collection of shared wisdom, years of pastoral care and spiritual maturity. So again, forums work well when there's intentionality for input and participation. And I'll keep repeating that because I think that is really where it's up to. It's having those supports and structures in place which proactively involve women, because I think as well-intentioned as people might be, and as people might give verbal assent to the idea of, oh yeah, of course we should involve women, unless you actively seek their involvement, it can just be unintentionally forgotten and left off. And so I acknowledge that it was the Elders and Deacons report in 2024, which acknowledged that governance bodies consisting of men and women serve together better to achieve outcomes. And that kind of finding is consistent with other kind of research that's been done around participation and inclusion of men and women. And I think it's simply because men and women see things differently. They have different perspectives on things. And we could say that about individuals, that we all have different ways of looking at things. But I think to only have, the voice of one sex, it's really missing. Well, it's missing half of, half of the population, essentially.
It's exactly when, in Genesis 2, when God creates man, and the first time creation is not good is when man is alone. The first time it's not good. And so God's made us to be together. And so we need to have men and women in these forums. I think I also want to say you've talked a little bit about the importance of female consultation and inclusion. And I think I want to acknowledge that not all men are elders. Being a male is not the qualifier for becoming an elder. And while in our denomination in New South Wales, we currently have male and female elders, most churches are only appointing men. I think the importance of including women in these spaces is also because we have women who are wise and mature in their faith and faithful and prayerful and spiritually competent, spiritually wise. And because they're not males, they're not being invited into these spaces. And so a man with all of the qualifying categories of being an elder is invited into these spaces, and a woman with all of the qualifying characteristics of being an elder may not be invited into these spaces. And so we actually lose something when we don't have women in the room, whether they're given the office or the title or not. I think we really lose something when they're not. There is no pathway for them to be heard, despite everything that God has given them that helps them fit into that space. I think that's why it's really important that we do good consultancy with our whole church, children, men, women, churches, and we want to see everybody included, everybody consulted. But I think, regardless of if you give them the title or not, when you see a woman with qualifications and characteristics that make her someone you need to listen to, bring her into the room, regardless of the title that she's got.
And I mean, my understanding is that sessions and presbyteries can create roles. They can intentionally create positions or committees or commissions or whatever they are, which will include women. And it's got nothing to do with challenging headship at all. It's really about seeking input from men and women.
Definitely. Presbytery meets in open court, so any person can attend presbytery and not be a member of presbytery. And sessions meet in closed court, but they can choose to extend privileges to people to join, and then they can close court again and remove the people when there's things that they need to discuss in confidence. And so there are pathways for those decision-making forums to be inclusive. We already have those in place. I think maybe we just don't talk about them. What aspects do you think could be improved in our decision-making forums?
So I think, again, if we go back to the body metaphor, that the church is missing out when parts of it are not given opportunities to flourish. And people need to feel safe, first of all, to express their views. So I think decision-making forums don't work well when people don't feel safe. And so one of the things is thinking through what can make someone feels safe. And a simple example of that is, and people not knowing their rights. And if for either session or presbytery, I heard a story recently where a woman did a pre attend presbytery and she didn't know if she was allowed to speak or not. And it wasn't until she expressed this later that one of the guys said to her, like it just didn't even occur to them that she didn't know her place there. And so giving her that information about, yeah, this is what it's about. You can speak or you can't speak, or you can speak at this time. Like that information would have empowered her to kind of know her role there and what she couldn't, what she could say, because in reality, they would have really welcomed her to say something, but she sort of remained silent because she thought she couldn't speak. So it's just like a very basic one, I guess, related to decision-making forums not working well is when people don't trust their leaders. And so congregations are told, and I do get this, you need to trust us, as in you need to trust the leadership team. But then the leaders also need to demonstrate their trustworthiness. And so, in the way that they're going about leading and shepherding their church, are they, what are they doing to earn that trust? And trust is relational. So are they spending time doing pastoral care? How they go about communicating decisions? Is it like a top-down approach, or is there a genuine consultation prior to leadership announcing decision about a particular matter which affects the whole church. So I think having genuine collaboration and input leads to good decision-making forums. When those things are absent, when collaboration is absent, when transparency is absent, I think that, that detracts from good decision-making processes. And I think also just going back to how well do people understand the concept of biblical headship, because it's never been about, from the Bible, it's never about, my way or the highway. I mean, the Trinity never operated out of, my way or the highway, but it was a relationship of order and submission out of love, and it's always evidenced love and respectful consideration. And I think, in good marriages, that's what you see. You don't see a lording over, but you see that the husband loving and respecting and wanting to hear the views of his wife. That's, a healthy, how it should be in a healthy way. And I think, churches can do that inclusion and that listening and that collaboration in a way that, is nothing to do with undermining headship.
So I've been in a lot of churches, including Presbyterian churches, and I think there have been times where I have trusted my session, and there have been times where I don't trust the session. And there have been times when I don't know my session. I have no idea who they are. The key for me in feeling cared for or safe to speak to them has always been that I'm known. So whether it's one elder or an elder and his wife, or but there's somebody who has come into my inner world and knows me outside of Sundays and knows me outside of the rosters on which I serve, and he's invested in me. And when I know that I'm known, I feel safe. And when I know that I'm known beyond what I can produce or, perform, I have so much confidence in that person's ability to make good decisions. And so I think the elders being shepherds of the sheep, doing that intentionally and doing that pastorally and doing that well, is definitely one of those things that allows people to feel safe and seen and trust. Instead of just being told, just trust me, it's much easier to trust in that space.
And I didn't talk about trauma-informed care, but it can be applied to these decision-making forums. So the five principles of trauma-informed care are safety, trustworthiness and transparency, collaboration, empowerment, and recognizing the unique characteristics of each situation and the individual. So in terms of communication, and we were talking before about people not knowing the pathways to access raising concerns, it can be as simple as, either having those things. I mean, churches have to have breaking the silence posters up. I think it's a really good thing when churches have somewhere that the information is accessible, whether it's on a website, your church website, or whether it's, in your weekly bulletin, to have the names of people that, are kind of like the contact people if you want to raise an issue, and have a male and female name. So providing information, it's an easy thing. It's almost like it's a no-brainer, but that's something that can improve in a small way, people even getting to the point of having input.
So what kind of issues do we even raise with the CPU, and where do you think we could improve our response?
So one of the things that stood out to me when I first joined the CPU was the existence of domestic violence. And the very first case that I assisted with involved domestic violence of a leader towards his wife. And it wasn't something that I was looking for, but I found that it was something that kind of came to us quite frequently. And I've gone around visiting presbyteries as part of just building on that partnership with them. In the presentation to them, I've been kind of talking through statistics. And so I've crunched our numbers for last year, and domestic violence came as the fourth highest category of notification. And notifications to the CPU are really broad, so it's not just people in leadership, but people notify about abuse happening to anyone. So it could just be people within the congregation. And so one of the things that I became aware of, or heightened awareness, is just that people didn't have the skills to respond well to those situations. And that was kind of the motivation to start developing the domestic training aimed at lay leaders. Like, these are people who do day jobs or they're at home and they're not trained to respond to this stuff, and nor do I expect them to. But we can give them some basic level of understanding and kind of some 101 type skills in how to respond well in that immediate phase. And I guess it's sad but not surprising that the incidence of domestic violence in the church is not really any different to what we find in the general community. And the statistics are quite shocking. So it can be, 1 in 4 women experience domestic violence since the age of 15, and they also say 1 in 14 men, but we know it affects men and women, and in many ways it's even harder for men who are experiencing violence to speak up about it. And so there was a national study conducted by the Anglicans in 2021 that evidenced that, and my experience in CPU is that really there isn't any reason for me to think that any different. Yeah, so that's kind of like a key issue that women raise with CPU. In terms of how we can improve our response, one of the things that has come out of that is the training. We've got the tip sheets. We've got a landing page with resources on domestic violence on the Breaking the Silence website. So if people haven't looked at that, I really encourage you to go and have a look at the Breaking the Silence website. It's got a whole range of resources on it, not just domestic violence, but about a whole range of other safe ministry issues.
Yeah, we'll link that in the show notes as well, so people can just click on that. Listening through one of the Apple or Spotify, you should be able to click on it through there. Or if you're listening off the website, we'll have the links there for you. Any patterns that you see, Vera, in the way that some women experience leadership and the decision-making forums in the church?
Yeah, there is a definite concern around how women's input is sought, particularly when a woman is needing to bring a complaint against a man to a group of men. I don't think it's necessarily insurmountable, but it, again, going back to intentionality, there does need to be given thought to and actions of how a woman's voice can be included or how she can speak in an environment which is going to make her feel safe. So an example, simple example of this is one thing that was introduced to Breaking the Silence a few years ago now is the necessity for presbyteries to appoint female support persons when the complainant is female, and also that idea that female advisors can be invited in when there's a complaint being brought by a woman. One thing that has come up again in discussion is sometimes presbyteries do a special visitation or they request a special visitation. And I would say, husbands and wives should actually be interviewed separately so that they can both have an opportunity to speak privately. If they're interviewed together, either of them might not feel comfortable to speak candidly if they know that their spouse is listening. So it's crucial to identify men and women who can be considered as safe people to raise abuse issues with, both in local churches but also within presbyteries, because that is a significant barrier for a woman if she's been abused by a man to be told that she can only bring the complaint forward to a group of men. That is a huge issue. And that was one of the reasons why there was the inclusion of the female presbytery support person, or both male and female.
Vera, in your time with the CPU, what do you think is working better than before? I hope that in the 8 years you've seen some improvements.
Look, I stand on the shoulders of great ones. So Liz McLean and John Flood before me really cut their teeth on it, the introduction of Breaking the Silence. And so I understand that there was great resistance to the impositions placed upon people, good people who simply wanted to serve. So there were, the whole prohibited employment declarations and the training which was required. And I think I'm the beneficiary of their hard work. So there is a greater understanding and acceptance that these kind of regulations are here for our good. And I think there's been a lot of different changes in legislation. So one of the other things that has come in has been the child safe standards, which were formed from the findings and recommendations of the Royal Commission, and those child safe standards are now mandatory in religious institutions. So we're captured in that. And I think those people understand the idea of compliance. And when we look at reasons for offending and perpetrating, the things that are protective are things like screening, really thorough screening. They are things like training and equipping people to recognize abuse, recognize the indicators of abuse, and then knowing what to do in terms of who do you tell. So I think those things are working better. And again, just going back to the issue of domestic violence, I think there is growing awareness and of understanding. And so, I really hope and pray that as a denomination, we are having better responses to victims when they raise issues. Certainly wasn't the case, 20 plus years ago, or even more recently than that.
And I think that that the Royal Commission into sex abuse in churches is part of that, the way that it's been in the media lately. But I also think it's so important that we remember those statistics of 1 in 4 women experience DV since the age of 15, and 1 in 14 men, but probably more than that. It's just that men don't report as much, and that the National Anglican Survey found that the prevalence was higher in Anglicans than in the wider Australian community. And so I think we need to keep coming back to that of maybe you personally haven't experienced DV, but that doesn't mean it doesn't happen in the church. And I think people are becoming more aware of that. I think the statistics are helping us to recognize that. What do you think could be done to improve some of the gaps that still exist?
So I think, again, going back to fully implementing intentional structures which seek the input and voice of women. So, this comes back to churches needing to think about, all right, where do women actually get a voice in our ministry structures? And if they realise that, oh, there aren't any, well, what can they do to put in some things that will give women that opportunity for feedback and input?
When you say giving women a voice, do you mean giving them opportunities to speak and be heard? Is that what I'm understanding there?
Yeah, but also to speak and be heard, but also to have input into sort of the ministries of the church. So, for example, there have been some churches where there has been quite a serious domestic violence incident, and those churches have prompted to go and create their own policies around how that local church is going to respond to domestic violence. And so, in the creation of that, deliberately and intentionally having women and men on those, working groups, I'll call them. And those working groups having an access to feedback to session. And I think also giving people time frames for feedback. So if somebody does give, writes to session and raises an idea or an issue that they do need to write back and acknowledge and sort of give a time frame of when we're going to come back and give you a proper response, not just a holding response like, thanks, we've received your letter, but actually a time frame of we will aim to get back to you within, so many weeks. And that kind of plays into the idea of transparency. I think, again, going to improving some of the gaps. Yeah, I want to talk about men leaders model that they're safe and respectful. That kind of pervades through the church. And one thing that I've encouraged the church to do recently is, if your church advertises that, hey, the CPU is running this training on domestic violence, I think that that actually communicates from the front. We think that this is an important thing and we don't want to tolerate it, and we want people to be equipped to respond well. I think that is a really a way of affirming that we value, I mean, majority of victims are female, but We know that there are also male victims, but yeah, it communicates from the front that we take these things seriously.
So the General Assembly of Australia has a Women's Ministry Committee, who I'm going to call the WMPCA, and they conducted a survey, I think in 2022, 2023, and the results of that survey were distributed across the last couple of years. And one of, I think, the things that I personally found concerning was that in Presbyterian churches in Australia, more than 50% of women acknowledged that they were unsure and hesitant to raise their concerns with male elders. Do we have any BTS structures available to women? Are there other structures? What can we do to help women feel safer in raising their concerns?
Yeah, so there is, I suppose, structurally, because a lot of the role of CPU is support and advisory, the things which churches have to do is they have to have the posters up, giving people a phone number that they can call if they need to or want to talk about an abuse issue or a matter of concern. We do ask the churches to identify male and female representatives from the church who can be approached regarding abuse issues. Sometimes these are the breaking the silence reps. The other thing that we've done is we do have posters which are designed to go on the back of the toilet door, which raise awareness of domestic violence. And we mentioned before about how sessions and presbyteries can appoint female advisors, but that sits outside breaking the silence. But if an elder was to contact me and there was an issue of concern raised by a female, I would be encouraging them to think about, well, how can you have some, female representation in the group that's going to hear this complaint? How can you have some participation in committees or key ministry roles, which shows that women are valued and are referred to the necessity for male and female support persons. So we only can inform people about the pathways that exist within the denominational structure, but some people don't even know what they are. So it is about that providing of information, and we do give feedback to General Assembly and various committees that have input into things like the code of discipline. I'm not going to go too much there, but we do give feedback to them about how they can better accommodate the needs of particularly female victims.
I think I definitely want to add there to be intentional about the women that you choose. So it's not just having women in those responsibilities that makes it better. I think one thing I see in a lot of churches is it might be the minister's wife or an elder's wife because that's who the session knows. But actually, that still can be seen to be too close. And so think strategically and intentionally. If you have an amazing minister's wife, I am a minister's wife. I don't know if I'm amazing, but I am one. So I'm not saying don't. If you have an amazing elder's wife, utilize her. But I think it's really important to also have a woman who's nominated who doesn't appear to be connected in to that structure of authority or, she's given authority in the church, but isn't married to the eldership. I think that helps to neutralize the person who's receiving the response or neutralize the person who feels like they have something to disclose.
Oh, you just want to be sensitive to conflict of interest issues. So
Yes.
that's, yeah, definitely something to be aware of. And then I think it does go back to the elders not knowing their sheep.
Yeah.
So a lot of this stuff does go back to building those relationships of trust and shepherding the flock and having the pastoral care. And, I don't say that simplistically because I know that sometimes, yeah, often elders do have the best intentions, and sometimes it is that limitation of time and resources, and there can be some pastoral issues which just require so much, and so it's hard to kind of spread it out. But church is thinking through if pastoral care needs to be devolved, then how does the care kind of filter through? How can there be structures which will allow for different levels of being known, as it were, and how do we care for those people at the different levels?
And I think again, this comes back to where we began of God has made us for each other. God has made women for men and men for women, and we work better together. And so how do we keep people safe? We don't have men alone making decisions, and we don't have women alone making decisions. We come in together knowing that the body is better when men and women are in the room dealing with concerns, dealing with complaints, growing the church more and more into that beautiful mystery of the Trinity. Yeah. Is there anything else, Vera, that you wanted to add? Anything we missed?
Yeah, not that I want to drum up business for us, but I would encourage people, if they do have concerns about abuse, that they can simply just call us. We're a resource to be tapped into, and I'd encourage the leaders to do that as well, because sometimes I think there can be a bit of a temptation to think they need to sort it all out, or we want to keep this in-house, or we can handle this. But yeah, we're a resource for people,
Yeah.
so use us.
Excellent. Thank you so much for your time, Vera. Appreciate what you do. Again, just a reminder to again a reminder to our listeners to just look at the show notes or go to the Jericho Road website to see more of the great resources that have been produced. Thank you so much.
It's been great talking with you, Sylvia.